and welcome to this week's episode of The Shill Report, episode 10. Guys, we made it. Of course, we're coming along the ride is Chris Spangle and Joe Ruiz. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hey,
what's up?
How's it going?
This is our 10th episode, fellas, of shedding the light of liberty on the news of the week. How do you feel about episode 10?
I feel that it's unfortunate.
The haters were wrong, including Spangle. We made it to 10. From 10, it's to 50. I feel it, guys.
No one
ironically, Spangle has yet to cancel the show.
No one hates this show more than I do, just because of the growing success. I swear to God, if you guys pass We Are Libertarians and subscriptions, canceled.
We are rapidly approaching. We are our tens and tens of listeners are stepping up to the plate. They're subscribing on iTunes and they are wrecking Spangle's life. So everyone, please keep it up.
We should thank the people who subscribe. We have a lot of new listeners. So maybe we ought to do just a quick reset here at episode 10 because, you know, the miracle of Facebook advertising, we've gone, you know, this is the 10th episode and we're up over 150 subscribers, which for a podcast this new is extraordinary, and it really is. It's great. I mean, it took We Are Libertarians almost a year to get that high. So, kudos to you, gentlemen.
And, so thank you.
Yeah. So thank you. Please share it. Please spread the word. And Ryan, why don't you tell the people a little bit about what we do here?
Yeah. Great points, Chris. We definitely want to thank the new listeners. Please do share the podcast. You know, keep it growing. What we do here, we take news stories of the week and we try to break them down and not only expose the spin of the stories, but to expose, you know, you, the listeners, to alternate views of the story. We also try to show where there's blatant media bias and also, in many cases, how forces work against the media and prevent them from giving a true or complete story, either on broadcast or in print news. And so we just decompose the news for you. We try to teach you to be better consumers of news. And even in some cases, we even offer suggestions and hints on how to become your own outlet of news if that kind of activity interests you. So it's really some educational content here, but we also have we try to have a good time breaking down the news for you, and hopefully we help you understand the stories of the day just a little bit better.
And let's introduce ourselves. I am Chris Spangle, and I'm the publisher and editor-in-chief of WeAreLibertarians.com and the WAL-radio.com network, just to plug that. And I am a former reporter, a former radio show producer, the former executive director of the Libertarian Party of Indiana. And also now I work in a marketing company that my main client is the Advocates for Self-Government, and I also consult for Howie Politics Indiana, which is a prestigious, it's like the Politico of Indiana. So I've been involved in all kinds of various forms of media and really, really enjoy talking about the future of the media. So Joe, why don't you tell the folks about your background?
Sure thing. I currently work in radio. My name is Joe Ruiz. I am the managing editor at WeAreLibertarians.com, and I am also the former 2012 U.S. congressional candidate for Indiana's 2nd District as a libertarian. Aside from that, I am a Chris Spangle lackey here on the website.
Yep. When I tell him to jump, he says, how high?
That I do.
And I'm your host, Ryan Ripley. I come from a writing background. Credits include SB Nation, writing about D-League basketball. Been involved in politics for a number of years. Ran for office a couple times as a party, which will go unnamed, as a member of that party. I've also worked within state politics and have pretty much involved in a number of campaigns and political party work for a number of years. And so combine the writing background with, you know, the political activities, and the show makes a lot of sense. And before Spangle hits me over the head with which party, I did run as a Democrat twice. And
hey, Joe's
finally saw the light, and I am now a card-carrying member of the Libertarian Party. So,
hey, listen, we all make mistakes when we're in college. Okay, I was a Republican. You know, we all do things we're not proud of in our past. I'm a former Republican. I helped campaign for George Bush. So, you know, Joe's a former Democrat.
I am a former Democrat, and I don't feel quite as embarrassed now that you put the George Bush thing out there.
You know, we try not to go down the partisan route on this podcast either. We really want to, let the talking heads fight that nonsense out. We really want to take a liberty-based view of the news, and even in many cases, a constitutional-based view. And you know what? Those ideas aren't exclusive to a party. They're predominant in a party, but they're not exclusive. And so if you come from a different political background than us, hang with us. You know, see if you like a few of our ideas, and see if we're able to at least show you another alternative to perhaps what you're used to hearing and seeing on the news. So
yeah, I mean, our whole goal is it doesn't matter what party you're in. We want you to think about the news and the future of media in a different way. Amen.
You know what, guys? I had a pretty exciting experience this week. For politicos like us, getting to talk to some of our political heroes, it truly is a huge honor. And this week, former New Mexico Governor Gary Johnson, he was also the 2012 Libertarian presidential candidate, he held a Google Hangout session where basically you jump online, and if you get in line quick enough, you get to ask him a question. Seeing as how I had nothing better to do on, I think it was a Thursday night, I was able to get the kids to bed and hop on the Google chat, and I was able to get in. And so I was able to ask him a question. I thought I'd play that for you guys because the question was media related. I dropped a hint at the site that we work for, so see if you can pick that out. And let's listen to the question. We'll listen to his answer. And guys, give me a little we'll do a little discussion on the question, see if you liked it, all right? So here's a clip. Hey, Governor, thanks for doing this.
Absolutely.
You know, my question is more on the media side. You know, sites like Reason and WeAreLibertarians.com and a few others have been really hyping up Al Jazeera America quite a bit. I know that during your presidential campaign that media coverage was difficult. I was just wondering, you know, which of the media outlets do you think are most fair or, you know, willing to talk to libertarian candidates? And do you think Al Jazeera America will bring a new dynamic to that process and open up discussions about more candidates?
You know, Ryan, I will just echo really what you're saying. Al Jazeera was and is terrific, and maybe they do open this up. I just right now what I'm seeing from mainstream media is this whole effort to label libertarians, and they're not doing a very good job of it. The notion that most people in this country are fiscally responsible, socially accepting / tolerant, I see the major media trying to label libertarians as being having a very social conservative agenda when in fact that is not the case. I do go back to the website I side with during the last election, where 3.5 million people got online, answered 36 questions, and then got paired up with the presidential candidate most in line with their views. I was the next president of the United States based on that I side with. Well, what's coming out of my mouth, I think, is really very libertarian positions. And now I'm back to this broad brushstroke of being fiscally responsible, monetary policy, spending, coupled with social acceptance or tolerance. And that would be gay marriage, a woman's right to choose, drug policy, and then certainly, another tier is military intervention. Republicans and Democrats both, at the end of the day, want to pull the trigger first and then see what happens, because nobody wants to be labeled as soft when the reality is what we've been doing and what we continue to do leaves us with more enemies to this country than less. Want to follow up on that, Ryan?
Yeah, just so that's a clip from Governor Johnson. I did ask a follow-up question, but then some hooligan on the Google Hangout actually muted the governor, and they wiped the entire Hangout out. They wiped everyone out of the Hangout and started over, so... we didn't get an answer on the follow-up, but as far as the initial question about the media, it seems like he is interested in Al Jazeera America. You know, he did go off onto the the presidential election and how that some of the coverage was impacted. But you know, definitely interesting insights from, you know, the governor and you know, hopefully Al Jazeera America, as we talked about, I believe last week, maybe they can open up some of the coverage for these third-party candidates.
Does not sound good, though. Their average viewership, they're in 49 million homes, and they are averaging 41,000 viewers. So it doesn't – it is – I mean, that is premiere week. You think about the amount of advertising money that they've spent. They just in every way are advertising the crap out of Al Jazeera, even on CNN and the other news channels, even on Fox News, and only to garner in their first week 49,000 is pretty. It's stunningly bad.
Well, it's one of those things that I think only time will tell. But it is interesting to hear Gary Johnson say good things about it. I mean, it draws that distinction between, we talked about this last week, and some of the things that Glenn Beck was saying. And so to hear different people who are prominent in the nation talk about that media outlet from a different perspective is interesting to me.
You know, another thing that came out of that interview just real quick is that it sounds like the governor is going to be open to possibly another run at office. So we'll see if we can get Gary Johnson back, at least on the ballot. You know, very interesting guy. He's someone that I hope that we can get on the podcast someday. It would be great to talk to him about, you know, experiences as a presidential candidate trying to work with the media. And so we are, I think we're working on that. Totally would be a great pleasure. Just getting to ask one question was fun, but imagine 15 or 20 minutes with him, guys. It'd be a blast.
I've met Gary. Gary endorsed me during the 2012 election. During my congressional run. He's a great guy. I don't think you could meet a more humble and more friendly person, and I think he was a fantastic candidate for the LP, best we've ever had. If you're a fan of the Shill Report, you're a fan of Governor Gary Johnson, and you want to hear him on the Shill Report or anywhere at wearelibertarians.com, drop him a message on Facebook. Let's put some demand out there, and maybe we can get the governor to supply.
Man, you guys are hardcore shills for the Shill Report. let us not move beyond without discussing the very smooth dropping of "We Are Libertarians" in the same sentence as "Reason," which, why the hell not, people? I was very impressed by your shilling for your own product.
Hey, we gotta push the product. We do it all for the listeners, Chris.
I would be remiss if I let that shilling go unnoticed. I must report you for being a shill.
On to other topics then. Something surprising happened this week, guys. It's something that I've never seen on from Bill O'Reilly. He apologized completely on air. He took we'll play the clip for you in a second, but to tee this up. So Bill O'Reilly was railing on the organizers of the MLK commemorative, the 50th anniversary of the speech, for not inviting Republican speakers. And he really he just railroaded Carville when he had him on the show, just saying, no, they weren't invited. It was wrong. Turns out Republican speakers were, in fact, invited to the event, and every single one of them declined. So once this news came to light, Bill O'Reilly, in atypical fashion, put out a full-fledged apology and dropped some very interesting, very interesting advice that I think every listener of this show could definitely relate to. So, or at least it's helpful advice for those of us that keep a watchful eye on the media. So here's a clip. See if you can pick out the key parts here.
Finally tonight, the fact of tip of the day. Last night during my discussion with James Carville about the Martin Luther King commemoration, I said there were no Republican speakers invited. Wrong. It was wrong. Some Republicans were asked to speak. They declined, and that was a mistake. They should have spoken. Now, the mistake, entirely on me. I simply assumed that since all the speakers were liberal Democrats, Republicans were excluded. So here's the tip of the day. Always check out the facts before you make a definitive statement. And when you make a mistake, admit it. By the way, I'm sorry I made that mistake. It's very annoying because I know you guys watch The Factor for accuracy.
Pretty surprising turn of events from Bill O'Reilly. He's usually not one to just step out like that, completely own a mistake, apologize, and leave it at that. I got to say, got to give him a hat tip for or at least owning the error and for going on the air and owning up to it and apologizing. Pretty impressed that he took that step.
Yeah, whether you love Bill O'Reilly or hate Bill O'Reilly, I think you definitely have to be fair to him in this situation. There are plenty of talking heads in the mainstream media who make assertions based on a prejudice for the other side, and they treat it as fact. And how many of them admit it? Did Bill get ahead of himself and essentially lose some credibility with the comment? Well, he definitely got ahead of himself, but he admitted that he made the mistake. And I think in the long run, that apology actually helps to build credibility more than the situation as a whole could hurt him. So absolutely right. Hat tip.
I've actually seen him do this before. You know, he is, to me, he's pretty even and fair, much. And maybe it's just because he's like next to Sean Hannity. And so he looks like this magnificent human being who's thoughtful. But I've actually seen him do this before. And yeah, I think it's great when somebody in the media comes out and says, I made a mistake. Here's the correction. I know you trust me. And to further that trust, I'm saying I'm sorry. So I thought that was really, really smart of Bill O'Reilly to do that.
Mm-hmm. Great job, Bill. And also the moral of the story was fantastic with, you know, make sure you're looking for the facts. I mean, that's something we talk about all the time here on the show report.
Yeah, I don't think you should trust. I mean, Glenn Beck says it all the time. Don't trust me. Don't trust anybody. Do your own homework. And I mean, that when it comes to Beck, when he says something offhanded, I Google it. And like 75% of the time, the story's there and he's right. But there's 25% of the time where he doesn't remember the story right, or he's twisting the facts. And it's the same with anybody else in the media. When you see in an article, if there's not a link to a story, then you ought to be suspicious of it. So you got to fact check when you're watching these, when you're watching these shows. You got to fact check as much as you possibly can.
You know, sometimes the fact checking is incredibly difficult, as our next topic will point out, because the actual sources of the story are anonymous. You know, we've heard in the media lately, the Edward Snowden story along with Bradley Manning, where they very publicly released classified information. Bradley Manning received 35 years in a military prison for doing so. Edward Snowden is in Russia under a one-year asylum agreement, his future in doubt. However, what we're starting to learn is that the White House actually loves anonymous quotes and anonymous leaking of information sometimes. So I want to ask you guys, you know, what purpose do these anonymous quotes really serve? And should people be skeptical of such comments, especially when people refuse to talk on the record, yet they still want a story to go out? What are your thoughts on that, guys?
It's just part of how the game is played. And this White House, especially, as we've seen this week, I think it is so extraordinary for a president not to put his face on camera defending his actions in Syria, or his supposed actions. And we talked this week a lot on We Are Libertarians about President Obama's just complete lack of accountability when it comes to this. He's trying to avoid any kind of accountability. And this is, it just starts with the top down. I mean, if the president doesn't want to come out and make his own case for going to war in Syria, then why would one of his staffers want to go out in public and make a statement and put their name on record as the person who leaked it? But the majority of the time, they're leaking on purpose. If you see that it's a senior White House official, that's a strategic release. That's not an offhanded comment that they slipped up and accidentally said that. That's Valerie Jarrett. That's Jay Carney. That is somebody who is feeding something to a trusted member of the press for a very specific reason, and that is legitimately their view. Now, why do they not put their name and face on it? The reason they don't do that is the baggage that may come with it. They don't want the message to get muddied by the messenger.
I think that's a great point. Go ahead. Sorry.
No problem. I was going to say, here's an example of the kind of things that have been coming out, especially about Syria. You know, a senior administration official familiar with the intelligence told CNN that the evidence includes but is not limited to satellite images of activity at Syrian military installations identified as including chemical weapon depots. So this is actually, I mean, this is kind of military intelligence as well. It's telling the enemy, you know, we have imagery of exactly what's going on. We've found some weapon depots. You know, this is, you know, even the battle plan has been on CNN this past week, guys. It's not just these anonymous quotes, but the entire, you know, we're going to tactically strike the following cities, and it's going to be limited in scope. And basically they're giving anyone in Damascus with an internet connection the ability to know what's coming. You know, I would question, is this, you know, are they aiding the enemy just as they would accuse Bradley Manning of doing?
I think it's a fair point. I think it's a huge, huge issue that you would leak your plans. Greg told us, again, to go back to We Are Libertarians, the other podcast that I run, you know, Greg told a story about how Nixon scared the Russians to death by leaking through a senior White House official that he had dementia and that he couldn't even remember his own name sometimes. And this scared the Russians so, it just scared them to death, because here's a guy who is with us on the brink of nuclear war and he can't remember his own name, and it terrified them. So sometimes there are, these leaks are strategic for whatever reason. I think the leaks from the Pentagon are, they're leaking because they don't want to go to war. There isn't anybody, including probably the president, who thinks that going to war with Syria is any kind of good idea, with the exception of Christiane Amanpour from CNN. She thinks it's a great idea. And, of course, the Weekly Standard, they're all for it. But that's it. That's all I've seen who are in favor of this. I don't know why they would leak it. There probably is some sort of reason, but it's one of the other layers of this where there just is no answer, there's no explanation, there's no reason. It just is, and it's all of it is confusing, every layer of this.
You know, there's actually an interesting exchange between, I think, Associate White House Press Secretary, I think it's James Earnest, who's taking some of the load off of Jay Carney, especially during the multiple topics that are going on and on. I mean, one can only deflect so much before the shields get worn down a bit. So they've brought in another guy. He had an interesting exchange that I just want to read to you guys real quick. He essentially said, "I leave it to you to decide whether or not you believe anonymous quotes that are included in Associated Press stories or an on-the-record statement from people who have looked at exactly the same information and reached a different conclusion," Ernest said, citing, among other public statements by President Obama saying that the Assad regime was definitely responsible for the attacks. Ernest's repeated denials prompted CBS White House correspondent Major Garrett to note that the wire service was a trusted news organization, and AP White House correspondent Julie Pace noted that you guys talk to us anonymously all the time. So it was an interesting exchange where, you know, Mr. Earnest tried to say, well, are you really going to believe an anonymous quote, or are you going to believe the president? And they basically slapped him right back and said, well, wait a minute, you anonymously talk to us all the time. You know, should we not trust any of that either? You know, just a really odd exchange, and it could be, you know, Mr. Earnest's inexperience is trying to run the press gaggle, or it could just be the way that this administration is treating the media, you know, the hands-off approach,
just
everybody's keeping everyone at arm's length is finally causing some backlash that that could start harming them as far as the narratives that come out in the press. What do you guys think?
By this point,
well, I think it's great that she.
Go ahead, Joe.
I think it's great that she stung him a little bit and caused him to eat his words. But in regards to anonymous quotes, I just think the world has changed a little bit. I think there was a time when the first rule of journalism was, when in doubt, leave it out. And that's something that writers and broadcasters followed as a whole, because losing credibility for inaccurate information or information that couldn't be proven, it kind of made you a journalistic leper. But in an environment where truth is so often scrutinized or frowned upon or even prosecuted in some instances like we've had recently, it seems that the promise of anonymity is often the only way you're going to get genuine information. And at the end of the day, I think that things have just become the opposite of what they should be, or at least what they used to be. People are at this point where they're now becoming more trustworthy of anonymous sources and more skeptical of the on-the-record comments made by politicians because, you know, we just believe that those are probably talking points that have been, you know, written with a strategic intention in mind.
By this point in John Kennedy's presidency, in 1963, leading up to 828 in the Martin Luther King, I heard this fact on the 50th anniversary discussions. He had sat down with the press corps, the Washington press corps, or the White House press corps, 19 times for back and forths. And those were on the record sit-downs back and forth. The last time that Obama sat down with someone from the White House press corps was 3.5 years ago. He's very unwilling to talk to the press. He's very unwilling. He will talk to the press in very controlled ways. You know, we're leading up to a war, and what does President Obama do? He gives an 11-minute interview to NewsHour with PBS because there he has the time. He knows they're not going to cut it down, and they're probably not going to challenge him that much. And he does a 5-minute press gaggle in the cabinet room at 2:15 yesterday. We're recording on Saturday, August 31st, and it's controlled. Nobody can ask a question, and he can just make a brief statement, and then they shuffle the press out. Chuck Todd went on Laura Ingraham this week and just said this is one of the worst White Houses when it comes to controlling the press. He just really unloaded on the administration this week, just saying they're a disaster. They have no PR sense whatsoever. Like, as much as we all say Obama's the great communicator, it couldn't be further from the truth. I mean, the guy doesn't know how to control his own message. He doesn't understand the bully pulpit. He doesn't understand that with 80% of the United States thinking that you need congressional approval to strike Syria, with 70% of the people against it, if you believe that going into Syria is the right thing, then you as the president ought to use your bully pulpit, sit out front, and say, this is a good idea. This is a Freudian slip there. This is a good idea. Here's what we're going to do. Here's how we're going to do it. Here's why it's in our national interest. Here's why it's part of national security. And you change public opinion. But Obama can't do that. He doesn't want to do that. He has no desire to do that. He just thinks that he should do what he needs to do, and everybody will just get along with it. They'll get over it.
Yeah, he's trying to execute and legislate at the same time as if he has a mandate to do so. And if you're not going to do what you said, Chris, and basically sit out, you know, outside the front door of the White House and talk through your plan over and over until the press gets it and the people buy it, you know, you're just going to put yourself at odds with not only the press but the American people. And so I think you've hit it spot on that his media handling, and whether we're talking about the NSA leaks or we're talking about Benghazi or we're talking about now Syria, it just seems it's been a continual series of missteps that have caused, you know, more confusion and more problems for not only him but the media, and in turn it's made it very difficult for the American people and for all of us to really understand what's going on within not only our country but within the media itself.
He doesn't feel like he owes us an explanation. Like, that's the outrageous part, is the guy doesn't feel like he owes the American people an explanation. He has no concept, you know, as a former community organizer who tried to move people to political action and inspire them to make a change in their community, the guy doesn't want to engage us in what he is doing as our public servant, because he doesn't view himself as a public servant. It's very troubling, and the fact that he doesn't want to speak to the people's representatives, the press, to explain what our government is doing, and when he does, his entire attitude is, well, if I just repeat this enough, you little brains will get it. You know, that was the whole thing. I think people need to understand the NSA better. So he puts Cass Sunstein in charge of changing public opinion about the NSA, because we'll feel safer about it once we understand it. Cass Sunstein has said that his hero is Edwin Bernays. Bernays wrote the book on propaganda. Goebbels, when they went to his home after they had killed him, found Bernays' book on the side of his bed as if it was his Bible. Cass Sunstein created the term libertarian paternalism and the concept of nudging people, that you just nudge people a little bit with regulations and they'll eventually do what you want them to do. The guy was head of the spookiest naming of any department, which was like the Department of Information and blah, blah, blah. He was head of all the regulations, and now this guy who loves propaganda is now in charge of explaining what the NSA is. And it's not Obama saying, gee, people are pissed off about this. We ought to make some reforms. It's, well, if you once you guys really see my point of view, you'll understand that I'm right. You know, if you can't tell, it makes me lose my mind.
Well, it's been very frustrating, guys. It's, you know, if you go back to Benghazi, where it started out as being about a video, and then it turns out it had nothing to do with a video, or if you look at the NSA, where it's been a series of missteps by the president. You know, he'll come out and say that there are no noted abuses of this system, and then, bam, Glenn Greenwald blasts out a story with material from Edward Snowden showing, no, in fact, these NSA analysts were looking in on their loved ones and on their spouses and girlfriends. And so it seems like every time the president tries to make us feel more comfortable about a situation, there's either a leak, an audit, a conflicting story that just throws his comforting statement right out the window. At this point, even if the president did stand out in front of the White House and try to give us this wonderful speech, do you think anyone's really listening anymore at this point? Is his handling of the media and his handling of the message just so tainted that at this point it doesn't even matter what he tries to do?
Well, I think it probably is. And quick point, watch what he discussed during his presidential campaign in terms of foreign policy and how conflicts or, you know, potential conflicts like what they're talking about with Syria should be executed. And then look at how he has handled those situations with Libya and with anything else that he's done during his time as president. And you will see that there is a deep, deep inconsistency. I think at this point, people should be kind of jaded. People should be bewildered that he has not lived up to the things that he said he was going to do or the way that he was going to operate as president. It's very non-transparent, and it's not good.
We had a similar discussion on this week's We Are Libertarians, again, about how the president can save this. He looks like a guy who doesn't want to do any of this. He looks like a guy who hates his job. And he could be a hero if he came out and said, I've made a mistake with the NSA, I've made a mistake with drones, I've made a mistake with Guantanamo, I've sort of kept my promises on Iraq and Afghanistan. And I'm not going to Syria. I'm not going. We're done with war. We're bringing troops home. He could be a hero, and he isn't letting himself. He knows what he needs to do. He knows what he wants to do. I believe that this president is an idealist, and I believe that he was speaking the truth of what he believes when he was candidate Obama, and before that. And I think he has betrayed himself and his own principles, and through that, us. And he could do the right thing, and he could save his legacy, and he could reverse the course of the last few years by coming out and just doing what I think he wants to truly do. I don't think he's a liar. I think that he just is in way over his head, and this is just all of this is speaking to the experience argument that John McCain made in 2008, which, thank God John McCain's not president, because we'd have troops on the ground in Syria. but, you know, Obama, with a certain segment of the population, probably 50 to 60%, maybe a little bit higher than that even, just it doesn't matter what he's going to do. They're never going to believe him. They're never going to trust him. You know, all the conservatives who, if he was against war in Syria, they'd beat him up for not going to war with Syria. You know, right. Just never going to make that group happy. But there are people like me who, if he did what he said he'd do when he gave that speech in Cairo, when he gave those speeches in 2007, if he did what he said he was going to do, I would praise him. and it just is. Mm-hmm. He's
me too. Yeah, I voted on him based on those things.
Right. So he can do the right thing. He still has the power to do it, and the people are going to be behind him, but he just, for whatever reason, can't.
Yeah, there's a lot of things going on there, and who knows what he sees and what we see. But at this point, I think you're right, Chris, and we've had this discussion in the past, and I've had this similar discussion with other people. At any time, he can stop this. At any time, he can get airtime on the TV. He can sit down with the American people and say, look, this has been a mess. I'm sorry. Here's what we're going to do to change it. And so far, he's just refused. And the media, to the media's credit, has not let up on many of these stories. You know, it's not just Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh beating their dented drums and trying to, you know, the president's mad, the president's mad, oh, mega dittos. It's not just that. I mean, you have Jake Tapper really digging into these things. You have guys like Glenn Greenwald, Bart Gellman. You have very credible and legitimate media outlets that are relentless in their reporting on these topics. And so we'll see if the armor cracks and if the president decides to change course. At this point, it looks like we're bombing Syria. I hope and pray that that the president sees the light and does not go through with it.
Aren't you? However, aren't you cute? Look at you.
I know. I hope that something happens. You know, I would have thought that the British Parliament voting against military intervention in Syria would have been a huge red light to the president, saying, "Well, maybe I should call Congress back and ask them for their permission as well." That has not happened. You know, what we're seeing is when the UK makes a decision to go to war, they call back their parliament, who they were also on vacation, as our Congress currently is, and they had a vote. Now David Cameron had to call the president and say, look, parliament said no, I can't join you on this trip. It's unfortunate that the president has not asked Congress to come back. It's unfortunate that the people's house, you know, our Congress, is not allowed. Basically, they've been called consultants. The president's come out and said, I've consulted with Congress. I want to know when the hell our Congress and our representatives turned into consultants to be conferred with when it's convenient. You know, the war powers sit with Congress. We elect these congressmen to keep an eye on the president and to keep an eye on the Supreme Court. It's a check and balance type system. They're elected to represent us and to vote within our interests. They are not consultants at the beck and call of the president, and yet this is what's happened. So, Chris, I'm with you. This stuff makes me crazy as well. We should probably move on to Indiana. Now, for the new podcast listeners, again, thank you so much for joining us. Many of you probably don't know that the three of us live in the great state of Indiana, and we have a governor who is former Congressman Mike Pence. And he's having some media problems as well. And some would say that this is his ramp up to a 2016 bid for the presidency. Others would say that perhaps he's making similar missteps in line with President Obama, which is an interesting coupling or pairing there. However, Brian Howie, who, as Chris mentioned earlier, who is essentially the Politico for Indiana, had an interesting comment. And then we've also linked a few, an article for you from WeAreLibertarians.com. But Brian Howie had this to say to the governor, some friendly advice to the governor. As a congressman, you championed media access and shield issues. As a radio and TV show host, you thrived on access to lawmakers. As governor, your accessibility has been far below that of your predecessors. You probably should rethink that. Now, obviously, we're having a media conflict between Indiana Governor Mike Pence and the media. Chris, you wrote about this on WeAreLibertarians.com. Do you want to give us kind of the recap of what you wrote? Again, the link's in the show notes. Please do visit our site. But Chris, you want to give us a little recap of what's going on between Governor Pence and the media, and then we'll play an interesting clip where, while the governor won't talk to local media, he's more than happy to go and play in the national scene.
Yeah, the Governor Pence formerly hosted a radio show. That's sort of his claim to fame that got him. That's why he was elected. I mean, it's hilarious to me when we were campaigning against him with our friend Rupert Bonham from Survivor. People would sit there and besmirch him as, oh, he's just a reality show. Is that his qualification? It's like, well, John Gregg and Mike Pence both for 8 years hosted a radio show, separate radio shows, on WIBC, the biggest talk station in Indiana. And that was their qualification, apparently, for getting elected to their posts. So here's a guy who was a broadcaster. You know, being a broadcaster, it's not the same as being a writer or, you know, being a broadcaster means that you've got to be quick on your feet. That means that you can take the press, take what they're giving you, and you can just fight right back and have those robust arguments. He was very, very good at that when he was in Congress. And for whatever reason, he refuses now to do that here in Indiana. I mean, the guy had a radio broadcast studio and bragged about it when he had that set up in his congressional office. So I don't understand why a guy who is clearly capable of managing his message in the press doesn't go and talk to the press. Now, my theory is that he is very, very tight-lipped. Everything that he said on the campaign was very vague, and there were platitudes that Indiana is the greatest state. I mean, it was basically like the writers of West Wing had written out his campaign script for him. And that
now,
is
Chris, I have a roadmap.
Right.
And that roadmap for Indiana is a good plan.
Right. I mean, that's all that we heard is his roadmap. And his roadmap was like bullet points, and it was, it was vague. So I think he doesn't want to sit down with the Indiana press because they know what questions to ask, and they would force him to answer more than just platitudes. His predecessor, Mitch Daniels, Mitch would sit down with the press almost weekly and have discussions. I mean, if not that, once a month. Pence has not kept that tradition up whatsoever. But when he does want to talk to the press, he goes on national news outlets, and he likes to quote-unquote, tell Indiana's story. Well, here's Indiana's story under under Mike Pence. His accomplishments are a less-than-stellar single General Assembly session where he begged and pleaded to have a tax cut, income tax cut, passed. He got a 5% income tax cut, which, who isn't in favor of tax cuts? But it amounted to about $40 a month. Or $40 a year for your average Hoosier. So big deal. And then he created another educational bureaucracy this a couple weeks ago in a state that already has way too much bureaucracy when it comes to education. Those are his accomplishments. But he goes on all these national talk shows. He's on the cover of Town Hall magazine right now with writer Essie Cupp, basically saying he's the guy that we need to run for president. And then he goes on MSNBC to talk about healthcare ideas. So what is the knock on Republicans when it comes to healthcare? Well, if they have ideas, we'll listen. They have no ideas. Well, so Mike Pence is the guy who goes out and touts the Healthy Indiana Plan, which is a state-run healthcare plan, i.e. more government, and touts it on MSNBC to show that he is the guy that has ideas. So that's the media that he is doing. He is going into the lion's den so he can say, you know, I had ideas, which was Mitch Daniels' idea. It wasn't his idea. You know, he is running on Mitch Daniels' record. He doesn't want to talk to the Indiana press because they know that he is a phony and a fraud.
Let's play that clip of Governor Pence bragging on Mitch Daniels' Indiana Healthy Plan, and then we'll pick this right back up.
Blueprint for the rest of the country.
Well, yeah, back in 2008, Indiana introduced what we call the Healthy Indiana Plan, which is an innovative, consumer-driven health care plan that allows people just above our traditional Medicaid program to have what amounts to individual health savings accounts. It encourages people to participate in preventative medicine. It is extraordinarily popular among the enrollees, and we just really believe that this kind of innovation is the natural result of giving states more freedom and more flexibility in a broad range of areas, including health care. And it's been a real success here in Indiana.
Well, what's the great innovation? What's the big idea from your plan that other states haven't done, that other states would be wise to copy?
Well, the big idea is that when you give people more ownership, more responsibility over their own health care choices, they become choosier shoppers. You invariably see people moving from emergency room care to primary care. The other thing we've done in this, too, is that we reimburse physicians at the Medicare rate, not the Medicaid rate. And so the opportunities for access to more primary care in Indiana has been significant. And, you know, at the end of the day, it improves people's lives. It improves their health care. And most experts recognize that the way you bend the cost curve in healthcare in the long term is by giving more Americans more ownership and more responsibility over their own healthcare choices.
There's Governor Mike Pence on The Morning Joe telling Joe Scarborough exactly how Mitch Daniels' healthcare plan works. But this is also the same guy who, when running for Congress and governor, you know, he'd be there, Tea Party! Limited government, roadmap, and that's how Mike Pence ran for office, and now all of a sudden he's touting the benefits of state-run healthcare. He really is a contradiction in so many different ways, as Chris pointed out. That he's clearly, I think he's gearing up for a 2016 primary against, you know, he'll be up there with Rand Paul and, you know, who else is jumping into this fray at this point? Probably a Ted Cruz will be up there, maybe a Marco Rubio. I think Governor Pence is trying to set himself apart, as Chris said, as a guy with a plan for health care. He's got the Daniels plan, which I hope he starts calling it the Daniels plan. And I think he's trying to get himself out there. And you're absolutely right, Chris. The Indiana press, you know what, guys, if we had 15 minutes with the governor, we could make him squirm, I'm sure, with the questions we would ask about the state. You know, I think this is just he's going to be a one-term governor who tries to be president, and this is for him, it's a smart tactic, as I think the local media, you know, guys like Brian Howie and, you know, quite a few others would just tear him up.
Yeah, he's a clever guy. Since he ran as governor, there were rumors that he plans to run for president in 2016, and I've even heard people accuse him that he had no interest in being governor of Indiana, but he thought that gubernatorial experience would be valuable to him during his presidential run. And I mean, in that case, we obviously can't confirm that, but if that's his intentions, then he's probably right. He's definitely not a Tea Party guy. Sorry, Rob Kendall. he's a Republican, and he'll be the moderate Republican, I put that in air quotes, on the GOP primary stage in 2016. But he does use the rhetoric, the Reagan rhetoric. If you notice throughout that clip, personal responsibility, ownership, flexibility, individual rights, states' rights, etc., he made all of those implications during that interview on MSNBC while still coming across as a moderate. Strategically, I think he's doing a fantastic job, and I say that with a very unfortunate tone.
I don't see how a Mike Pence presidency would be any different than a Barack Obama presidency or a George W. Bush presidency. It looks like, you know, the moderate views, they all line up together. I can't imagine how it would be much different than what we have today. And I hope that our local media continues to hammer on the governor and get him on the record on issues and make him talk. I mean, you know, we are his constituents at this point. We have the right to know what's going on in our state. And until, you know, he gets a little more open about these things, I really would love to see guys like Brian Howie and, you know, people up here in Fort Wayne and in South Bend, and Chris, with you in Indianapolis, I'd love to see, you know, the three big cities, their local press continuing to just hammer away and chip away at the governor and trying to get more and more out of his administration.
And that is the bottom line in both of these stories. When you are serving the public, you have a responsibility to sit down with their representatives, the press, and that's why the press needs to take their job seriously. You have a responsibility to sit down with them and explain what you are doing. Plain and simple. It's as easy as that.
So we'll move on to another interesting big government type story. The fast food strikes that have hit the news, and I think we're going to get through this one quickly because, gentlemen, I do have a Jay Carney Says What for us this week. So we're not going to spend too much time on this. However, this story has really hit the press. We feel the need that it should be discussed a little bit. Basically, fast food workers across the nation have gone on strike, or they are striking, in order to get the message out that they feel that they deserve or should have a living wage for the work that they do. I don't want to get too deep on the economic lesson here, but I think Henry Hazlitt would be freaking out at this point to hear that. Trying to, and for those of you that don't know, I think he wrote Economics in One Easy Lesson. And essentially, labor has a value. And so if my work is worth $5 an hour, raising the minimum wage to $10 does not make my labor worth $10. What it means is that I will become unemployed and they will hire someone worth $10. First of all, you have people like Melissa Harris Perry going on her show and essentially spewing out these odd facts and figures that don't add up to anyone with an economic understanding of how these things work, and essentially saying, yes, these people deserve these wages, and yes, it's going to be the greatest thing for the economy, when in fact, I would say that most Austrian economists would say that raising the minimum wage is the most surefire way to have the lower-income families suffer the most. You know, Chris, have I missed the high points and low points there, or what do you think?
No, I think you're spot on. I mean, it's the minimum wage is a perennial topic, and it is something that is – it just seems so right. I mean, we can't have – unfortunately, the problem is, you know, I come from a long line of small business owners, and do you think that – you know, my dad who runs a small business, do you think he wouldn't love to pay somebody $15 an hour? You know, doing janitorial work? Of course he'd love to pay somebody that. Would he love to give them health care? Of course he would want to give them health care. But he can't afford to because he is bidding for projects because he's a vendor. And so when he bids on these projects, he's got to come in at a certain level. And so that demands that he can pay his employees a certain amount because he's got to pay for insurance. He's got to pay for, you know, taxes. He's got to pay for equipment, and he's got to pay for labor, and he's got to make a living at some point as well. The whole argument in the media is always what a bad guy the people who are paying these low wages are. Well, they're not bad guys. Walmart, McDonald's, people like my dad, they employ people. They take great amounts of risks, and sometimes they pay a great price. You know, not to get into my family situation, we've paid a lot because my dad's been a small business owner. You know, have there been bright spots? There sure have been. But there is also every December my dad sitting at his desk going, gee, I hope that an invoice gets paid this month so I can buy my kids Christmas presents. And every small business owner out there has that same struggle. And, yeah. You know, it is... It just is the demonization of the job creator that just is so ridiculous.
Yeah, the thing about economics and what the situation actually does when you call for a higher living wage is that if an employer is forced to pay a higher wage, then they are going to have to absorb that somewhere else. And usually that means that the service or the products that they provide to the consumer, the price is going to go up on that. But when the price goes up on the service or the products that you're putting out to the public, that means that less people are going to buy it because then it's become more expensive. Maybe that's going to go above the market rate. And so because less people are buying, it's going to cut your productivity. So the next logical step for a business owner is going to be to cut his staff, cut his employees, lay people off. And so people have gone from maybe being paid $5 an hour or whatever the market would deem them worth in that instance to having no wages at all. And Melissa Harris Perry, she's argued before that these living wages or the minimum wage being so low is the reason that more people are on food stamps. And that makes a lot of sense to a person who has a big government. Government needs to do everything to help everything be fair and to give everybody everything, that mentality. But the truth of the matter is that if we could lower taxes, if we could decrease spending, and if we could allow markets and people who run businesses to pay people what they are contractually worth and what people are willing to work for and let things just kind of handle themselves, it would be a lot more free, and you wouldn't need to have these conversations about constantly increasing, because the more you increase, the more people are actually going to be put in a hard financial position, and the more the government is going to be perpetuated and continually asking for more. That's what Hazlitt would say. That's what's in Economics in One Lesson. And that's the point that most of these talking heads, especially in the more liberal-leaning media, always tend to miss.
And you guys, so for the listeners out
you guys
there,
are such racists. You guys are such racists.
Well, before we get a ton of hate mail for hating poor people or for being racist or for whatever it is that you feel that our economic positions are at take, please do go to Amazon.com or your favorite bookstore. Look up Economics in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt. At least give it a 30-minute look. There's a chapter on minimum wage. Read it. At least educate yourself before you simply, you throw down the racist card, you throw down the, you hate poor people card, and try to understand that raising the minimum wage hurts poor people and business owners the most. It is, if you really want to decimate the budget and the ability of a lower income family to feed itself, raise the minimum wage. That's a war on the poor. And on that, guys, that was some mental exercises there. I think we have covered the news of the week pretty well. It's time for a little, I think we should enjoy ourselves with a round of Jay Carney Says What. What do you guys think?
Yeah.
I disagree.
And that
I
reminds
missed it last
me.
Week.
You missed it last? I think Beat the Tweet was fun. We're going to bring that back.
But, no, it was a lot of fun.
All right, guys, I'm looking at the clock. It turns out we are right up against the wall. We don't want to run over for Gary Snyder on Indiana Talks. He doesn't like it when we go just a minute over, so we're gonna end it at this week. We will have a Jay Carney Says What queued up and ready for next week. Maybe we'll do it first next week, reverse order, have a little fun, and then get serious. So,
why would we want people to throw up as soon as the show starts?
Who knows? we'll mix it up a bit. But Jay Carney Says What, it'll be back next week. We'll have Joe's jingle to go along with it. He did a great intro and outro. But for this week, guys, that's the news of the week. If you'd like to get a hold of us, please leave us a message on the We Are Libertarians Facebook page or the at We Are Libertarians Twitter account with the Shill Report hashtag. Find out what we left out of this episode on page 2 of the Shill Report, available at wearelibertarians.com. Listen in on iTunes or wall-radio.com to hear past episodes. The Shill Report also plays on indianatalks.com. And remember, when the media breaks the news, the Shill Report is here to fix it. Have a great night, everybody.